We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In March, Illinois Governor Pat Quinn abolished the death penalty. When he signed this bill, the governor called it the most difficult decision that he had made as governor. He said, "We all know that our state has had serious problems with respect to the system of the death penalty for many years." He said he'd studied every aspect of Illinois' death penalty, and he concluded that it was impossible to create a perfect system, one, he said, that was free of all mistakes, free of all discrimination with respect to race or economic circumstance or geography. This law will go into effect on the 1st of July, and when that happens, Illinois will join with 15 other states that have done away with executions. At the same time, public opinion polls show that a majority of Americans do continue to support capital punishment, although over time, the numbers that support the death penalty have declined. In this part of Focus, we'll try to talk about this change here in Illinois, what it means, and also look at the complex and expensive system that exists to carry out the death penalty. And our guest for the program is Lee Beenan. She's a senior lecturer at Northwestern University School of Law. She's also a criminal defense attorney, and her areas of expertise include capital punishment. She's also taught law at Princeton University and University of Pennsylvania School of Law and University of California School of Law. She's joining us this morning from Northwestern. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. We invite people into the conversation now. We hope people can be brief in their comments, stay on topic. That way we can get in as many people as possible. But callers are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send in your question or comment by email, you may do that as well. And the address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So at any point here you'd like to be involved in our conversation, you're welcome to do that. And Professor Beenan, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I know that you've written a good deal about this and have reflected on the fact that back in the mid-90s, when you came here from Princeton, at that time, certainly the capital punishment was as you have written, very firmly entrenched in the state. And one would imagine that that wasn't simply going to change. So then it was just 5 years after that that then-Governor Ryan imposed the moratorium, and so now we have Governor Quinn signing this bill abolishing the death penalty. Maybe you can just reflect on how big a change that is over a relatively short period of time.
You know, it's ironic because when I came to Evanston in Chicago with my husband, who was coming to be the president of Northwestern University, I had been working on capital punishment in New Jersey, working very closely with the New Jersey Supreme Court on a topic called proportionality review, which was basically analyzing the way that capital punishment was imposed in New Jersey. And I had been doing that work for 10 years, as well as writing and speaking about capital punishment and being involved, very heavily involved with it, both on national level and in New Jersey. And so I said in 1995, well, it's very clear that nothing is happening in Illinois with regard to capital punishment. And it wasn't. It wasn't. There were more than 160 people on death row. There was a Supreme Court which had long said that it was not going to overturn very many death sentences, that it was a legislative decision. It was not within their purview to question the system. They pretty regularly upheld death sentences. The governor had approved executions. He commuted, I think, one or two sentences involving battered women. I think in 1996, that would be Governor Edgar. But more important, there was no really strong state-based national institution which was in a position to challenge capital punishment. Now, there was a very strong legal community, not just in Chicago, but across the state as a whole. And there was a very active sort of legal and citizens group, which had been arguing for abolition for years, for years. But for example, one of the things that was striking to me when I first came to Chicago was the difference between the institutions of the state prosecutor and the state public defender in Illinois and New Jersey. In New Jersey, where I worked for the Department of the Public Advocate, we had a statewide public defender system, and that system was unified at the center for both appeals and for county trials, and that made an enormous difference. So that when capital punishment came in New Jersey, and it came in relatively late in 1982, it was a coordinated effort by the Department of the Public Advocate to challenge it. From the very outset, we would assign two public defender trial attorneys to every capital case. We'd spend $1 million regularly on the defense of those cases. And we had a Supreme Court, which was not elected, with a very strong Chief Justice, Chief Justice Wilentz, who was committed to examining how the death penalty was applied. We also didn't elect county prosecutors. And I think that's a critical difference. The state's attorneys in Illinois have always been an extremely strong political force. They have been very strong in their support of the death penalty. And there are 102 of them. They're across the state. And as they themselves have said repeatedly, they answer to nobody in how they select cases for capital prosecution. There's no central review. There is nothing which says to the individual state's attorney, we're going to review or check or have a something to say about whether or not you select a case for capital prosecution. Mm-hmm. And in Illinois, the statutory aggravating factors, which is the basis for a case, an ordinary murder being declared capital, was very broad. Extremely broad. And the legislature kept adding statutory aggravating factors. You know, who in the legislature is going to vote against having a new statutory aggravating factor? You know, there's a horrible murder, and a new statutory aggravating factor comes in saying that all cases involving a victim over 65 or somebody who is disabled will now be a capital crime. You know, it's very interesting, the whole question about support for the death penalty, because, for example, in all states which have abolished, and also in Great Britain at the time when they abolished capital punishment, public support for the death penalty was more than 50%. Now, so that's not going to change. So even when states abolish, if you ask most people the standard question that's asked time after time in the Gallup poll, are you for or against the death penalty for murder? They will say yes. Now, the interesting thing is when people are told facts about the way the death penalty is imposed, and that's just right across the board, the support for the death penalty comes down. So that if you say to people, are you in favor of the death penalty for murder? Yes, right? But then if you say, well, are you in favor of the death penalty for murder, although it's been demonstrated that the people who get the death penalty are very likely to be poor people who don't have adequate counsel. Then they say, well, support comes way down. If you say, are you in favor of the death penalty for murder, even though it has been shown very convincingly that the people who get the death penalty and are executed are much more likely to be African Americans, minorities, etc., right? Again, support comes down, right? So the more people know about the way the death penalty is imposed in their state and across the country as a whole, the less they support it. Mm.
There are one might cite a number of problems with the death penalty and cite those as reasons for opposing it, and you've mentioned a number of them. That is the involvement of politics in the judicial system, the problem of inadequate representation for people who are charged with capital crimes, the fact that it is unequally applied. Now, here in the state of Illinois, though, I think that the thing that really happened to put pressure on the governor and move him to put the moratorium into effect was we had a number of very high-profile exonerations, people who had been charged, had been found guilty, who were awaiting execution, and that new evidence showed that they were not guilty. And I think that a lot of people perhaps were moved by this idea that we could not say for certain that a person who was not guilty would not be put to death. And that seemed to be the turning point. Do you think, in fact, that was that some doubt about the possibility that we could execute somebody who was not guilty was the
I think it was very important. Let me just say, when I say in 1995 it didn't look like anything that was happening in Illinois, that's correct. And no one was more surprised than I was after spending like 8 years working on and writing about capital punishment in Illinois and being a member of the Illinois State Legislature's committee to study the reform of the death penalty, a series of reforms which were enacted by the legislature in 2003 and which also created this committee of people from around the state, and we issued a report, et cetera, et cetera. So no one was more surprised than I was when the legislature in January voted to abolish the death penalty. And I think the exonerations were extremely important, but those didn't happen overnight. And there were a series of events which started in 1998, beginning with a very large conference at Northwestern University School of Law on the Innocence Project and the establishment of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University School of Law. And the commutations, the discovery of innocent people on death row in Illinois and elsewhere rolled in. It didn't happen overnight. Some of these cases were cases which had been worked on for years. People had been trying to gather this evidence. But, you know, it was like a snowball. And not just in Illinois, but also nationally. And there was the Innocence Project with its headquarters in New York, and around the country, there were these reports of innocent people being sentenced to death, coming within days of execution. The most dramatic one in Illinois was the case of Anthony Porter, who came within 5 days of being executed. His case had been upheld by the Illinois Supreme Court twice. He had gone through all his federal reviews. He was about to be executed when his execution was delayed on the question of fitness or competency to be executed. In other words, a completely technical, unrelated to innocence claim. And then it turned out he was completely innocent of the offense. He was innocent of killing these two people for which he was about to be executed. Mm-hmm. So that case made a big impression on the public. It was one of several such cases. And then there was quite a bit of publicity and attention paid to wrongful confessions, a statute involving wrongful confessions and the videotaping of homicide confessions was passed by the legislature. So, you know, all of a sudden, a lot of, how shall I say, stories and information about miscarriages of justice in the capital punishment system, not just in Illinois, came out. And that had a huge effect. Huge effect. Mm-hmm. And then in 2000, the governorship changes. You have Governor Ryan imposing the moratorium on executions. Now, a lot of people think that Governor Ryan abolished the death penalty. So, you know, it's quite surprising to me that you will go somewhere and you will talk to educated people who read the paper every day and have PhDs and are professionals, and they say, didn't Ryan abolish the death penalty in 2000? No, he didn't. He didn't. What he did was he introduced a moratorium on execution. So what he said after presiding over his first execution, he said, no, I am not going to preside over any more executions. He said, there's going to be a moratorium on executions. Illinois was the first state to impose that. Other states followed. Mm-hmm. And he said, there's too much error. He looked at the wrongful convictions. He looked at the people on death row whose confessions had been coerced. He looked at the case of Anthony Porter, who was totally innocent and was about to be executed. And he said, you know, this isn't going to happen under my watch. Now, I think the personality and character of Governor George Ryan was very important. And I think it was very important that he did not come up in politics through the state's attorney. And particularly, he didn't come up through the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. He was not a lawyer. He did not really know very much about criminal law. He was sincerely and honestly and genuinely shocked to find that innocent people had been convicted of crimes and we're sitting on death row. Now, I just don't think that most prosecutors and most defense attorneys would be shocked by that. Hmm. They know the system. They know this happens. They know their mistakes. But as he said, I'm a pharmacist. A 50% error rate would be too much for us. We'd be fired. We couldn't do our jobs. And that was the point when more people had been found innocent and taken off death row than had been executed since the reimposition of capital punishment in Illinois after the United States Supreme Court decision in Gregg. So now people say, oh, well, Ryan, you know, he was just cynical. He knew there was this prosecution against him, and he just wanted the positive publicity. I don't agree with that. You know, life is complicated. Of course, he knew there was this prosecution against him, and I do think that was very important to his deciding not to run again. But, you know, people have very different strains, and they have very different loyalties. I think he was a very serious Catholic. I think it really bothered him, the death penalty, and that innocent people might be convicted. And so his being there and him being taking the step of imposing a moratorium on executions when Illinois had more than 160 people on death row was huge. Now, let me also say that the legal community, and particularly the staff around George Ryan and the staff at the Center on Wrongful Conviction, played a critical role. The newspapers played a critical role. You know, those columns in the Chicago Tribune, in the Sun-Times, in the other newspapers about the wrongful convictions, about the interrogations, about the false confessions, about police misconduct, they were critical. The newspapers, and especially the Chicago Tribune, played a really important role. Eric Zorn, his column after column on the Rolando Cruz case and the Hernandez case. Mm. You know, you just can't underestimate that, the importance of those newspapers, of the legal community in Chicago and across the state. Next thing you knew, there was some committee of 500 prominent lawyers and judges who were saying that, you know, they thought there should be a review of the system. It wasn't fair. You know, again, those things don't happen overnight. You don't have one little not-for-profit saying we're against the death penalty and all of a sudden things change.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Lee Beenen. She's a senior lecturer at Northwestern University School of Law. She is also a criminal defense attorney and has written a lot on the subject of capital punishment. In fact, one thing you might look at if you're interested in reading some of her thinking on the subject, you can look for a book that's a collection of essays on capital punishment. The title is Murder and Its Consequences, and it is published by the Northwestern University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you're interested in participating by email, you can do that as well. That is will-talk@illinois.edu.
Let me also mention, David, that for anybody who has access to LexisNexis, there's an article in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology, that would be volume 100, number 4, fall 2010, called Capital Punishment in Illinois in the Aftermath of the Ryan Commutations by me. It's available online through LexisNexis, and it's the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology, volume 100, number 4. And that actually, it has a lot of statistical data and a lot of facts about how the death penalty was imposed in Illinois, and also how it was paid for. Because I think one of the things that happened in Illinois was that questions of cost came to the fore. I mean, it was not irrelevant that Illinois had the worst pension deficit of any state. You know, it was just not irrelevant. And evidence showed that the money that had been set aside for the death penalty had been spent foolishly, haphazardly, in a way which didn't seem to make a lot of sense, and it was gone.
Well, we have a caller and some emails here I want to get in, and of course other people who are listening, definitely you're invited to join the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Have someone here at Effingham. They're on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I am going to quote your guest just now. I think she said, life is complicated. Did you mention, did she mention that in the, those terms?
Well, I think that was a reference with regard to Governor Ryan's imposition of the moratorium, and I was saying some people criticized him and said that they thought it was a cynical move on his part, and I said that my own personal view was that that was not the case. Of course, one can never prove these things, but my personal view is that that was not the case.
Well, if I could go ahead, then if I misconstrued that, I'm sorry, but life is complicated.
Definitely.
And recent events, and I hope that I'm not going astray here with what I'm about to say, and the execution murder of Osama bin Laden. One must know the ramifications of the Middle East over the last 1,000 years in order to understand, and then under the capitalist system and how denigrating that is, and how many people have died because of that without any sort of law that takes into account those who execute the economy and those who execute war and colonialism. So that is my comment. I think it is all relative. That's why I called, because this subject needs to be examined thoroughly.
Well, I'm not exactly sure how it applies to what we're talking about here this morning, but I guess people are... They take advantage of the fact that they can essentially ask any question they want. So you can comment on that if you like or not.
I thank you very much for your comment. I would just like to say I think that one of the most important things that public radio and public television and the newspapers and the media can do is encourage people to inform themselves, to be as informed as they can be about the facts of certain situations, and particularly about what their government does. People should always check their facts and make sure that they're accurate. And it is one of the great contributions of the press to our society to encourage that.
I want to come back to the subject of proportionality. And I was really struck by the fact that in one of the essays that you include in Murder and Its Consequences, note that on average in the United States, there are something like 16,000 murders every year. Well, we certainly don't carry out 16,000 executions every year. In fact, since 1976, when the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty, there have been, maybe fewer than 1,200 or not many more than 1,200 people in all of that time.
Correct.
Have been executed. So you really have to ask this question. Well, look at if it could be done. Look across the country. Look at all of those people who are charged with murder, and who might be eligible for the death penalty. How many of them in how many of those cases do prosecutors actually decide to go for the death penalty?
Or
and
not.
How is it or not? And how is it that that decision ends up being made, that in case A, we will say yes, that
right.
We will, but in case B, we'll say, well, no, we're not going to do that.
You know, I thought when I was working in New Jersey, we worked on this, what was called proportionality review. Now, there are two aspects to proportionality review. One is the sort of general common sense view, which you just articulated, which is, okay, you look at all the murders, you look at who's eligible for death, and who gets it, or who is sentenced to death, and how is that case reviewed, and what are the characteristics of the people who get it, and who doesn't get it, okay? So, and then there was the rather more technical aspects of the review, which is how proportionality review was brought to the attention of the New Jersey Supreme Court, and what the New Jersey Supreme Court did to ensure that they had a reliable database of cases, et cetera, et cetera. Now, let me just at the outset say that the Illinois Supreme Court never did proportionality review. After the United States Supreme Court in Gregg said that proportionality review was required, and then later the United States Supreme Court said, no, it really wasn't required for the states to do it. Illinois and a number of other states just said, you know what, we're not even going to bother with this. Now, I have to say, in terms of moral force, moral force, and persuasive power. The argument which we brought in New Jersey and was brought in Illinois in a somewhat different way was that, look, you had 12 people on death row. You had 50 people who were charged with death over like an 8-year period or something like that, right? And you could do a match. You could say, for example, the person whose case was the vehicle for the proportionality review before the New Jersey Supreme Court, Robert Marshall, whose case went through appeals which lasted 20 years before finally the local Monmouth County prosecutor said, you know what, it makes no sense, after his death penalty was overturned yet again by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. It makes no sense to prosecute this person for murder. But for every person sentenced to death, you could find a twin. You could find another case where the person wasn't sentenced, was not charged with death, did not go to capital trial, was not sentenced to death. So, for example, Robert Marshall, who was a white middle-class man who murdered his wife, murdered his wife to get her $1 million insurance policy so that he could run away with his girlfriend. There, he was sentenced to death in a county in Monmouth County, represented by private counsel, who, when the money ran out, when he was finished with the trial and sentenced to death, and that counsel was later found to be incompetent by a number of appellate courts, he was sentenced to death. His case goes up on proportionality review, et cetera, et cetera. There was a twin case, which was even worse. It was a man who killed his wife, hired a hitman to kill her. They wrapped her up in a rug. They tortured her. They took her to some warehouse. It was even worse than Marshall. And the prosecutor did not charge death. For another case where somebody had killed a child, horrible murder, horrible rape, murder of a child, there was another case, or two or three other cases. Same circumstances, similar facts, horrible murder, death not charged. It's very interesting. So you have to ask yourself, what makes a case a death eligible case? And you know, it's kind of curious to me, but you know, one of the essays in my book, Murder and Its Consequences, is an essay I wrote quite a long time ago called A Good Murder. And it's an essay which talks in a general way about what makes a case the kind of case that a prosecutor wants to charge for death. What is it that makes that case one that they want to go forward? Now, in another book of mine called Crimes of the Century, I talk about cases which, for one reason or another, capture the public imagination. They become cause célèbre. So, you know, the most outstanding example is the Lindbergh kidnapping. Also, the O.J. Simpson case. For some reason, these cases levitate. You know, they become national obsessions. And you can't really predict it. I mean, you can look at it afterwards and say, oh, yes, it was this, it was that. But you can't really predict it.
In this hour of our program, we're talking with Lee Bean, and she's senior lecturer at Northwestern University School of Law. She's a criminal defense attorney, has written a lot about capital punishment, and that is what we're talking about here this morning. We'll have more in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, host of Live and Local on FM 90.9. Join me each weekday at noon for an hour of conversation with local musicians and other performers, as well as guest artists visiting our listening area. We feature frequent live performances in our studio and a daily calendar of events you can see and hear live. It's Live and Local, your connection to local music and more, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. We are here weekday mornings with 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, we'll talk about the federal budget and the negotiations going on between the president and Congress. Our guest will be Alan Schick. He's professor of public policy at University of Maryland. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, Sandy Mason will be here for a monthly show on things that grow in the home landscape. Thursday at 10, pardon me, at 11, we'll have another visit with Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carl. We'll talk about children's health. And then also this week, we'll have another installment of the thing that we're calling the Deep Archives. This year, this program has turned 30, and one way that we're celebrating is by going back and re-airing some programs that have been recorded, but they're not part of the web archive that we have. So there are shows that have not been heard in a long time, and we're digging through them to find some things that we think are interesting. And in fact, this time around, you'll be hearing an interview with Newton Minow, one-time head of the FCC. This week, in fact, I believe it is today, is the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of that famous speech in which he referred to television as a vast wasteland. So you can hear some from him on the program on Friday. You can get the schedule for the entire week. Also, listen to some past shows you might have missed first time around by going to our website. It is will.illinois.edu. In this hour of the program, we're talking about capital punishment, and our guest for the program is Lee Beenan. She is senior lecturer at Northwestern University School of Law and is criminal defense attorney and has written a lot about this subject. And questions are welcome. We do have someone standing by, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, and we'll also take emails at will-talk@illinois.edu. And let's talk with someone in Urbana. This is next in line one.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I'd like to make a layman's comment, you know, regarding this issue. I'm not a lawyer. You know, I have no background related to law. And for quite a long time, I've been sort of a mild supporter of the death penalty, but I came around to be a relatively firm opponent of it, and I supported Governor Quinn's decision to, you know, to sign the law here in Illinois abolishing the death penalty. And even though I'm not religious at all, I'm actually an atheist, my objections to it are primarily sort of moral and ethical. I think that even if we had a, if we did have a perfect system, you know, that was administered completely, in a completely fair and you know, impartial and balanced way, it would still probably not be, you know, the right thing for the state to execute people. I think that if you look at the problem in the historical perspective, you know, 100, 200, 300 years from now, you know, probably our posterity, they will look at the death penalty the same way we look now at things like judicial torture, which were completely legal, completely acceptable and normal, you know, ways of interrogation in the Middle Ages. You know, they were actually even considered necessary. So now we look at them at as kind of, you know, perhaps historically understandable, but nevertheless, you know, barbaric practices. I think that, you know, over time, when, you know, the society will grow to appreciate, you know, and value human life more, you know, the death penalty will be viewed in a similar way. So even though, you know, there are very legitimate process objections, you know, to the death penalty, I think for me, ultimately, the deciding argument is a moral one.
Thank you very much for your comment, which is a very thoughtful one. You know, it's quite interesting to me. My students often ask me, are you really against the death penalty in all circumstances? What about this horrible murder, murder of a child, etc.? And my response is, as a person, as a citizen, as a family member, if somebody murdered my child, my husband, my loved one, I would want to kill that person myself. I would want to kill them with my bare hands. Right? That would be my response. I would want to murder that person myself. Right? But that doesn't mean that I think, and I think that many victims, not all victims, but many victims feel that way.
Exactly.
But that doesn't mean I think that the state should do it. And I don't think the state should do it, even though there are offenses which are so awful, so terrible, that you say to yourself, this person should not live. Anybody who has done this should not live. But I don't think the state should be in the business of sorting that out, trying to apply it in a way which makes sense, because the historical record is absolutely clear that the state has done a terrible job. I mean, they've just made a lot of errors, which are, you know, human errors. People make mistakes. people do things they shouldn't, institutions operate in ways that they shouldn't, they have bad incentives, whatever.
Yes, but my point is slightly different. I think that even in cases where it is absolutely clear that the person is guilty and deserves
yes.
to die, that doesn't necessarily mean that it is the right thing to kill them. You know, so there is sort of a difference here between, there are people who deserve to be killed, but it doesn't mean necessarily mean that we should kill them. Ultimately, I think the act of abolishing the death penalty, you know, or not abolishing the death penalty says something more about, you know, our values as a society in relation to, you know, to human life and basically to humanism than sort of more immediate fairness considerations.
I agree with you. I think that you're completely correct. And indeed, the United States is out of sync with many other countries who are like us, the European Union has abolished the death penalty. Britain has abolished the death penalty. Even Russia has basically abolished the death penalty. So who keeps it? Well, it's like not a list you would like to be in the company of.
Well, I want to thank the caller again. Questions, comments are welcome. We have maybe about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. And our guest is Lee Beenan. She's a senior lecturer at Northwestern University Law School. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222.
David, I'd also like to thank you for this program and for having programs on things like the budget, which is a difficult, complicated issue, and the more factual, basic information we can have and discussion about it, the better.
Well, that's what we're trying for. And when the show's over, then people can tell me whether they think the effort was worth it or not. Let us go to another caller here, Champaign County, and this is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I applaud you having a budget discussion next as well. I would, the philosophical aspect aside, which was just sort of treated, the particularity of the Illinois experience, it seems to me, I was very moved by the speech that Ryan gave in New York, where he wasn't just talking about the inefficiencies of the death penalty, he was actually attacking corruption like jailhouse snitches and all sorts of the things. I don't think he named, and maybe he did, the kind of torture that was going on under the Burge regime, and it had to be widely known. And it seems to me one of the things that isn't discussed is Daley. I suppose Ryan couldn't have pulled it up. He was the DA at the time when this torture regime of coercing confessions was happening, which produced, a majority of the death row people that had to be released afterwards. I'm not sure on the statistic on that, but certainly it had a role. You know, it was there's a lot of the personalist aspect of the police that's attacked, but when you have a policy that insists on a quick, apprehension, and you're willing to go to, you know, what Burge learned in Vietnam in the way of using electric shock and all the other primitive ways that they were torturing confessions out of people, I mean, it's hideous. Just putting Burge away for lying is not enough. It should go up the organization, and I'm going to hang up now and listen. Thanks.
Thank you for your call. Yes, it's very disturbing, and of course, one always wonders, like, who knew? How long did it go on? And it did. There was a systematic pattern there. It was documented. It was challenged. It took years for it to get into the courts. There were several court cases, one of which I believe resulted in an acquittal. Finally, Burge was found guilty of perjury. It was a long battle, and there was definitely a culture of corruption there. And it's very disturbing, and one would like to think that it would not be tolerated in a civilized society.
I'd like to have you talk about something else. You know, one of the things that has happened with the death penalty over time, first of all, there was a time when executions were public events.
Correct.
So we have moved them behind closed doors. And the method, we have moved now largely to this method of lethal injection because we think that is somehow more humane. And one may put that in quotes. What does it say that we have hidden the whole business away? And we have even tried to medicalize the whole procedure. That seems to be all an effort to somehow deny what it is we're actually doing.
Well, I actually think that the medicalization of the death penalty, as it's referred to, is a very important part of the history of capital punishment in America. And indeed, even if the death penalty had not been abolished in Illinois, there probably wouldn't have been an execution for quite a few years because there was a challenge to the method of execution being lethal injection, ready to go in the courts as soon as the next execution was scheduled. And indeed, this has been a national movement as well. So, you know, there are two sides to it. One is the side which says, hey, supposedly these humane executions aren't so humane. Things go wrong. People have the wrong drugs. Some people suffer. Part of the execution technique is to paralyze the person being executed. The sole purpose of including that drug is to sanitize the procedure for the people who are watching the execution. There still is a tradition of having witnesses to executions. It used to be not only were executions public, but they were attended by large numbers of people. So that, for example, when the Haymarket defendants were executed in 1887, there were 180 people who attended that execution in a closed setting, right? Mm-hmm. And remember, lynchings were public events. You see pictures of lynchings in which hundreds of people are watching this lynching. You know, you don't hear 20, 30 years later people saying, oh yeah, I was at a lynching, or maybe you don't hear it in certain kinds of society, right? But executions were public. One of the more bizarre aspects of the history of capital punishment in America is that when the electric chair was introduced in America, people went around the state of New York debating the question of alternating current and direct current, okay? Mm-hmm. And they would have these public meetings where they would electrocute cows and horses. Can you imagine? And people would watch which was more humane. I mean, this is incredibly bizarre. So when you hear about things like this, you have to ask yourself, what were people thinking? And I do agree with the caller who said, I think we'll look back on the history of capital punishment in America and executions in America and we'll say, you know, I don't know what people were thinking then, but I'd like to think we've put that behind us.
Yeah. I have an email from someone here who wondered whether you could say something about the case of Troy Davis. Are you familiar with that case?
I'm not. Perhaps you can give me some context?
Well, all I can say is just from what little I can tell you here from doing some quick research, apparently this was a man who was convicted of murder in Georgia. He was convicted of murdering
right.
a police officer.
Yes.
And apparently there was a lot of eyewitness testimony, and people
yeah.
have since recanted, and
Correct.
There's all sorts of questions about it. And he himself has maintained that he was wrongfully convicted.
Right.
And he's now been on death row, I think, for something like 10 years.
Yes. Was he not executed, or has he? I don't remember whether or not he was actually executed.
I don't think that he, at least from what I'm looking at right now, I don't think that he
okay.
he was. Now, maybe the
but
information
was,
I have here is out of date.
Let me also recommend to any of your callers who are interested enough to listen to this program, the Death Penalty Information Center website. That's dpdeathpenaltyinformationcenter.org. Anyway, they maintain all the up-to-date information on the lethal injection challenges, on which states have abolished, how many people are on death row, et cetera, by state. And they would have up-to-date information on the Davis case and others. Perhaps I'm confusing his case with another person who consistently maintained his innocence and for which there was exonerating evidence and the person was executed anyway. I'm not recalling the name of that case, and I'm sorry about that. You know, the history of Georgia and the Georgia litigation is extremely interesting because the main cases that went to the United States Supreme Court challenging capital punishment, Furman v. Georgia, Gregg v. Georgia, McCleskey v. Kemp, all Georgia cases. And indeed, United States Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell later said that was the worst vote of his career. Mm-hmm. The vote in McCleskey.
Right. Well, I'm now on the website of the Death Penalty Information
Good.
Center, and there is some information here on the Troy Davis case.
Thank you.
The most recent is from apparently last August, so I would assume that if, in fact, he had been
right.
executed, it would say so. So at least as far as that's concerned, I think that he is he would still be on death row and,
right.
and still pursuing an appeal in his
Does
case.
The caller have anything particular he is interested in?
Well,
with
it was just
that case?
All the email was, which is, could you say something about the case?
So. Sorry, I can't help you there. So I refer you to the Death Penalty Information Center.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of the show. You know, I think that one of the arguments I think people make in favor of the death penalty is they think that it acts as a deterrent. And that people will, that perhaps people might be on the verge of committing a crime, might be on the verge of killing someone. And the idea is that somehow they will think, oh, well, it's possible that I will be caught. If I'm caught, I could be tried and convicted and I could be executed. And that stays people's hand as they're about to do that. And I think other people would argue that based on what we know about murders and their circumstances, that people aren't actually making that kind of calculation at the moment. Do you have any sorts of thoughts about the deterrence argument?
I do. You know, the deterrence argument is an argument which is one that makes a lot of common sense to people. You know, people say, you know, if I thought I was going to be executed, it would be a deterrent to me. I wouldn't commit that murder, right? Actually, there are a number of very serious, different, wide-ranging studies of deterrence and capital punishment. They show that capital punishment is no deterrent. There are some studies which show that the murder rate is higher in states which have capital punishment. These studies are scientifically valid. They are statistically valid. They're footnoted in my journal, Criminal Law and Criminology, article. In fact, one of the things that happened is the Professional Organization of Criminologists, the American Society of Criminology, they felt the statistical arguments, the scientific arguments against the deterrent theory were so strong that people actually stopped doing research on it. You know, it wasn't considered statistically interesting because the evidence was so clear that it wasn't a deterrent. So, you know, in the 80s, the professionals kind of stopped working on it, and they were always surprised to see that the issue was still kicking around. It's like, you know, the evidence was overwhelming. It's like, do you wash your hands before surgery? Yes, it makes a big difference.
Another of the arguments that on the other side, and we've discussed this a little bit, arguments are made against the death penalty is that the problem that many people who are charged with capital crimes are very poorly represented by their attorneys. And there are some places where some efforts have been made to address that issue. Now, here in the state of Illinois, if we no longer have the death penalty, it's still going to be possible that someone could be charged with murder and sentenced to life in prison without parole. So that's still a pretty serious sanction.
Exactly.
And I think a lot of people would make the argument that we still have a very significant problem with the kind of representation that's available to people that can't hire their own lawyers. And that is just as much of a problem. Now, at least we can say if someone is before we could say if someone was sentenced to death and they're executed, there's no taking that back. Well, now we have taken a step back from that line, but that we still have a serious problem with our public defender system.
I think we do have a very serious problem. And indeed, one of the big arguments I thought against the death penalty, which was very persuasive, was that it's such a distraction for the system. You know, there's all this argument about who gets the death penalty, who doesn't get the death penalty, who's about to be executed, does the governor support it, et cetera, et cetera. We ought to be worried about cleaning up our criminal justice system generally. We ought to be worried about getting people better representation. We ought to be worried about getting proper support for the state's attorneys so that they can do their job properly and have the experts that they need. So, you know, we have some serious things we should worry about in the criminal justice system generally, not just with regard to the death penalty. I mean, the death penalty is what I call the whirlpool in the large stream. And the large stream is the capital punishment system generally. 16,000 murders a year in the United States. And, you know, very few of them are prosecuted as death. Every single one is a tragedy for the victim's family, the victim's loved ones. So, you know, what's happening in the criminal justice system generally? And as you say, a sentence of life without possibility of parole means every single day for the rest of your life. Now, that may be justified in some circumstances, but perhaps it isn't always. And we should be thinking about how to make our criminal justice system better. And in my experience, let me just say, most of the public defenders that I know in New Jersey and Illinois are competent. They are hardworking. They do the best they can. Sometimes they're overworked. Sometimes they have too many burdens. Sometimes they're not paid enough. But frankly, my experience with public defenders is that mostly they do a good job.
Well, I'm sorry to say, at the point where we're going to have to stop and we have one more caller we can't take. We're just going to have to leave it at that. With our thanks to Lee Beenan. She is a senior lecturer at Northwestern University School of Law. She's also a criminal defense attorney. She has also taught law at Princeton, at University of Pennsylvania, and at UC Berkeley, has written a good deal about this subject. And is the author of a collection of essays. And again, if you're interested in reading on the subject, you might take a look at this book. The title is Murder and Its Consequences, Essays on Capital Punishment in America. And it is published by the Northwestern University Press. And Professor Beenan, I want to say thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
Thank you for having me.
And also thanks to the technical director, Brendan Cosgrove, there at the other end of our connection there at Northwestern.